Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today our special guest is Frank Joseph. And Frank, you may know as the previous editor of Ancient American, but right now he is an author who is turning out the books almost on a monthly basis. It seems that he has found the liberty and freedom to get some great books going, and what he has done before for the magazine, he's now doing in book format. So, Frank, first of all, happy season's greetings and all the best for 2011, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, and happy winter solstice to you and Kathleen.
And the same to you. Frank, you started out as running Ancient American, and I think I'm right in saying that your prime interest or one of your earliest interests had to do with giving a completely different perspective on the history, the prehistory, the origins of the American continent. Am I right in that?
Yes, that's correct. I always felt that my education left me with more questions than it provided answers. And I felt that what I was told in school just did not make sense about the origins of not only American civilization, but of world civilization. And that led me on to what has turned out to be a lifelong interest in determining the truth. I'm only interested not in theories or my own opinions. I want to find out where our roots really go back to, and that's important because that explains where we are now and where we're going.
Absolutely, that's our motto as well. And the question is, kind of like, you know, over the years, where has that taken you? What kind of understanding do you have about what America is and was?
Well, it's taken me on an extremely radical and divergent course. And it's because of that that I suppose you might refer to persons like myself as alternative investigators, because our research shows that the paradigm, that the consensus history that we've been fed for so many decades, actually more than 100 years now, is almost completely wrong, and especially as regards the origins of American society, organized society, civilization. Fortunately, other sciences other than archaeology, which is an interpretive science, actually it's a humanity, it's not even really a science in the sense of the geology, but geology and now especially genetics, the DNA analysis that's now available to us, is portraying an entirely different point of view than we were told in our university training 20 or 30 years ago. And I think that's very exciting. It not only validates what alternative researchers like myself have been working on, but it also opens up brand new vistas, a fascinating, fascinating prehistory. And that's, I know it's all been rather general I've been talking about, but we now know that an organized society, a true civilization sprouted in America 1,000 years before Christ, 3,000 years ago. And archaeologists had a very dim view of this, a rather shady view of it, but now it has been fine-honed by these alternate sciences, and it's very exciting. And that's what I have been working on, as the true beginnings of American civilization, which go back very far, contemporary with dynastic Egypt and long before Rome.
Frank, why do you think that traditional historians and traditional sources on American history are so afraid of these ideas, are so afraid, because as you say, there's fantastic evidence here to look at. There's extraordinary information. And they seem to ignore it or turn their backs on it in a pretty thorough and complete way. Why are they so afraid of it? What are they afraid to look at?
They not only turn their backs on it, they actually fight it. They oppose it. To answer that question would require more than one program, unfortunately. And there's many really responses to that. Two of them, I think we can address though a little bit. One is just professional arrogance. You find that actually in all the sciences. And there's just a very ego-driven sense of personal propriety. In other words, they have a point of view, almost a theological view of the past. These professors then will go ahead and have books printed, and then they use these books as textbooks for their classes, and it gets frozen. There's no flexibility. But I think that another reason is a very practical and understandable one, and that is many of these archaeologists have to deal with Native, especially in the United States, with Native American people, with tribal peoples. And it's important for them, it's imperative for them to do their research, that they have a very good working relationship with these tribal peoples. And therefore, they don't want to have any information which they feel might denigrate the notions that these Native peoples have of their place in American prehistory. I'm not putting down all archaeologists by any means. There have been some fantastic discoveries that they have made, some great finds. But unfortunately, the general overall trend of American archaeology, I don't find this in other countries necessarily, at least not to this extent, but nonetheless, the overall trend of American archaeologists is a very ultra-conservative, inflexible view of the past, which has been outdated now for really more than 100 years. It's a fossilized science. And as a consequence, I have a very low opinion of modern archaeologists for the most part, especially those that teach the version in the school. Even many of these archaeologists have been confronted with irreproachable scientific hard evidence that at least part of their theories are dead wrong, and they'll either ignore it or they might give it a condescending nod and then go along teaching the same old thing. The same old thing is that, maybe 12 or 13,000 years ago, some Siberians just happened to wander across a land bridge that connected Siberia to Alaska, and eventually filtered down into California and so on. And those are the origins of human society here. Well, that is now a totally invalidated point of view, and it's been invalidated by not only comparative finds between Ice Age Europe and the earliest known cultures here, but also by the DNA evidence. The DNA evidence, for example, is enough to totally destroy their position. The DNA evidence showed that after 5 years of collecting a DNA sample of all the native tribes in the United States, it was discovered, especially amongst the northeastern tribes, the Algonquian peoples, a strong Celtic strain that runs through numerous Native American tribes, especially the Ojibwa. And this Celtic strain, well, of course, DNA can fine-tune things now, goes back about 3,000 years ago, and that this DNA is today carried by Native American peoples. Even more amazing than that, on the West Coast of North America, especially the tribal peoples of British Columbia, there are genetic DNA traces of Japanese strain that go back 20,000 years ago. And then if you want to really go far back, there is a professional mainstream archaeologist by the name of Virginia Steen McGintyre, and she and her team about 30 years ago unearthed unquestionable evidence for the use of fire by human beings in Mexico a quarter of a million years ago. And because of that, she and her team were driven out of the so-called science of archaeology. She has stood by her research. She has published it. There's no peer review because nobody will touch it. But nonetheless, it's hard fact. And evidence like this utterly demolishes the line that has been drawn in the sand by archaeologists. They say that there's no foreign influence in the Americas, not only North America, but Middle and South America before 1492. That before Columbus, nothing was here from anyplace else. And that is still the dogma that they adhere to. And it is totally fossilized and totally out of date. I'm sorry if I sound so passionate about this, but nonetheless, we are being taught in American schools a lie, total falsehood.
We love your passion, so don't apologize for it. You know, your passion is clearly what's driving you to get to the truth, and this is an incredibly exciting subject. You know, and Philip and I both in our own work have encountered the exact same obstacles that you encounter as well. I get it from historians and biblical scholars, and you know, Philip has certainly seen it in all kinds of archaeology and especially Egyptology. So we definitely resonate with all the things that you're saying about the frustrations toward getting to the truth. As an Irish girl, I can say that, you know, we're taught that, you know, St. Brendan came to America, you know, over 1,000 years before Columbus. And, you know, so there's certainly a lot of information in the Celtic world, at least legendary information about the Celts coming to America. And I think all that's incredibly exciting. What I wanted to ask you, for those of our listeners who are discovering your work for the first time, I think that they would love knowing more about this. And is this something that you cover in your book, Advanced Civilizations of Prehistoric America?
Yes, it is. I try to focus on that, and that's been that book, The Advanced Civilizations of Prehistoric America, is something I've been working on for, it must be close to 20 years now. And thanks to Ancient American Magazine that I used to be associated with, actually I'm still associated with, I'm no longer the editor-in-chief there, but nonetheless, I've been able to, thanks to that magazine, collect an abundance of rare and otherwise totally unseen materials that I think portray a very exciting view of the past. And yeah, you're right, that's what I've tried to focus on.
So when we talk about a Celtic influence in the Native American traditions and in their DNA, are we saying that there was interaction between, in terms of trade routes or contact between these countries, or are we saying something else?
I don't think there are trade routes. What it appears to have happened is that the Celts were an extremely restless people. We know that around 3,000 years ago, established history tells us, and quite rightly, that the Celtic peoples who had been living for time out of mind in the steppes of central Russia were forced by declining climate conditions to evacuate the area, in a sense. And so they went through Poland and Eastern Europe and spread out all through Western Europe. And they appear to have been a people always on the move. And part of that move was getting in their magnificent huge ships, which were larger than anything Rome had, and arriving here in North America. And we think that one of the reasons why that took place was because the Celts were a very prolific people. Their population swelled. We do know that for a fact. And that some of them came over here. Quite a few of them came over here. So it was part of the migratory process that the Celts were involved in, really, from the beginning. They were a very dynamic people. Well, even today, the Irish people are a people who have contributed to a large measure to the greatness of so many other countries. That's typical of the Irish wandering mentality, that they love their homeland, but they always move on. They go through other parts of the world. And that, I think that restlessness, that creative restlessness, that creative dynamic was as much at work 3,000 years ago in the world as it is today.
Absolutely. And this notion of the fact that quite often, like, you know, I kind of like see this line running between Mexico and the modern United States. And when you look at the world of archaeology and history, it's as if that border has always been there, like that somehow the Mexicans, the Mayans, and all the other civilizations of Mexico never went further north of this border, as if they all somehow knew that, you know, like they had to keep it virgin territory for the coming of Columbus and like. So how do you see ancient America as a whole continent? Do you see people moving about from north to south? Is it like, you know, are there certain areas where there were less interactions? How do you see this picture of America, really?
Well, you know, I think that's a very excellent observation you have, Philip, that there does seem to have been less communication throughout the North, Middle, and South America than one might really have imagined, that these were almost preserves, as it were. The Maya, the Aztecs, they do not appear to have been people that were as much on the move. And when the Celts arrived in North America, we do know that they set up a kind of a, not a state exactly, but a territory that was pretty clearly defined in the west by the Mississippi River, and in the east, of course, by the eastern seaboard, and maybe as far south as, oh, Kentucky. That's about the extent of their area. In the north, maybe, oh, through Wisconsin, that area, concentrated primarily in the Ohio Valley. This is a very large area, admittedly, but nonetheless, this is where you find the Celtic focus. And this isn't anything which is dreamed up or theoretical. Archaeologists have known about a culture which they call the Adena. The Adena, that's just as an archaeological name. It refers actually to a plantation, a farm. We don't know what these people called themselves, actually, although some research indicates that we do know what they call themselves. But anyway, the Adena culture has been known to archaeologists for about 150 years, and a close study of the Adena culture, the very artifacts that the archaeologists have brought up, the mounds that they've broken into, is virtually a mirror image of contemporaneous Celtic culture in South Germany and in Brittany and in Ireland, especially in the graves that were dug by these Adena. They, for their elite, would create a large earthen mound, and then in this earthen mound they would create a chamber, sometimes two chambers, which were lined with gravel and logs, and then the logs were filled in with a kind of flint and more gravel. This is a rather fingerprint a burial sepulcher that the Adena did. You only find that same fingerprint funeral arrangement among the Celts. You'd find it no place else, and those same mounds that were being created in the Ohio Valley by the Adena were at the same time that the Celts were doing these exact same burial configurations in South Germany, in the Hallstatt culture, and in Ireland and in Brittany. And that's only one of numerous coincidental pieces of evidence, which is very, very powerful. Because, as I say, you cannot find that sort of grave configuration in any other part of the world. So with these people, we call them the Adena. Archaeologists refer to them as the Adena. But a closer study of Native American traditions talks about these people, and they called them the Yom Kodesh, which means literally the red-haired giants. And the story of the Yom Kodesh is known amongst virtually every Native American tribe east of the Mississippi. And they refer to these people as having come over across the sea and landed on the eastern seaboard of the United States and spread to the Mississippi, and they created a kind of polity there, kind of not exactly a nation, but a political form. And that they were people noted for their great stature and their fair hair. Well, strangely enough, if you excavate some of these mounds, like the Miamisburg Mound in West Virginia, archaeologists came across the skeleton of a 7-foot-tall man. And at first they thought, well, this is just a skeletal dislocation over time. But more and more of these skeletons have been found, and it turns out that the Adena, or the Yom Kodesh, as the Native Americans refer to them as, were in fact a people of extraordinarily high stature. There have been the tallest female skeleton found so far was 6'8 or 6'9. She was 6 feet 8 or 9 inches tall in life. And the tallest man skeleton found so far is 7 feet 2 inches. So here is an example of where Native American tradition actually is validated by the hard physical evidence. And in Western Europe, the tallest skeleton from ancient times that has ever been found is in Hallstatt culture in southern Germany and in Austria, and they also have found the remains of Celtic leaders who were about 7 feet tall. Now, today, the Celts are not quite as tall as that, although they still produce some pretty large individuals. So there appears to have been some kind of genetic change over the past several thousand years. But beyond that, again, the comparisons between the Celtic culture and that of the so-called Adena is just remarkable.
Absolutely. And one of the things I greatly enjoy reading is a work by a professor called Barry Cunliffe. And he is a person who has been mapping prehistoric Europe. And one of his things is the sea-facing nations of Western Europe. And basically, he's identified that from roughly Morocco all along the Atlantic of France, and then the west coast of Britain and obviously Ireland, all the way to the Orkneys, you have contact by these tribes, by these people, sharing common characteristics all across their culture. And that the contact between this, you know, like 2,000-3,000 kilometers, miles of people happened via boat. And when you then go to the Orkneys today, you find a gigantic civilization, very detailed, very beautiful. And you also find that the Orkneys were used post-Columbus as one of the primary means of traveling across the Atlantic towards America. And I find it so interesting and so bizarre that, you know, like, people do not make those connections, including professors like Barry Cunliffe, who has gone a long way into mapping this, but doesn't seem to be willing to go the final way. Now, when it comes to this transoceanic contact, which we're talking about, I want to somewhat change subjects, but I think we're actually going to stay on the same subject, because you have written a number of books on Atlantis, including your most recent one, which is Atlantis in 2012, but it is really just one of several, which clearly suggests your fascination with Atlantis. So, Atlantis, Frank?
Yeah, that, of course, that's the A word. That's as, just about as radical as you can get. I didn't start out looking for Atlantis. But when years ago, back around 1980, when I began studying these questions for the first time, a kind of an X culture kept arising. For example, we were told in school that the earliest civilizations were in the Nile Valley and in Mesopotamia. And okay, that's where civilization first started. But then if you take a close look at these civilizations, and also in the Indus Valley, they just sprouted overnight. There is no previous development. All of a sudden, they are just there. Especially if you look at the beginnings of dynastic civilization in Egypt. Before 3100 BC, there is a rather small population of rather primitive peoples. They lived in a very low level of material culture, and they had been this way for tens of thousands of years. And then, literally overnight, there is massive irrigation taking place, irrigation techniques. You have monumental constructions, huge works with monumental sculpture. You have codified religion, medicine, astronomy. All this from 0 to 100 miles an hour, as it were. The same thing takes place in the Indus Valley. Again, rather low population, not much for material culture. And then bang, zoom, you have a highly literate people, a highly complex mythic view of the past, highly developed metaphysics, again, medicine, astronomy. And then you go over to the Valley of Mexico. Again, the exact same process taking place. So the impression one gets when you look at these so-called earliest cultures is that they were all imports, that somebody had taken a long previous time someplace else to develop these things and then plant them, as it were, in these other parts of the world. That's in a general point of view. And then when you begin to fine-tune your research and you look around at what else is going on in the world, what was happening, you realize that there were tremendous natural upheavals that shifted populations around all over the world. And these natural upheavals were nothing short of global catastrophes. These global catastrophes are recognized by geophysicists today that they, in fact, did take place. We know for a fact, for example, that around 3100 BC, there was a very close call with a very dangerous and huge comet, which still exists today. It's referred to as Comet Encke. It was named after Rudolf Encke, who was a Swiss astronomer, who found it back, I believe, 1790s. It's not much of this comet exists today, as it goes around the sun that loses most of its material. But astronomers using computer science have been able to sort of dial back in time and show that this comet Encke, which is now just a ghost of its former self, was an extremely bright and powerful and dirty comet that made a very close path to the Earth around 3100 BC and showered down literally a barrage of meteoric material. This is now established as actually having happened. Well, 3100 BC is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because that is around the time that a dynastic civilization erupted in Egypt. It was the time that the Sumerian civilization got up and running. There had been some previous work there, to be sure. Sumerian civilization really, you can see its beginnings around the middle of the 4th millennium BC, but it's around 3000 BC that it becomes the recognizable civilization that we know today. 3100 BC or 2800 BC, the Indus Valley turned into this fabulous civilization. So we can kind of conclude from this that some natural catastrophe, which we associate with this pass made by Comet Encke, disturbed a former civilization and scattered its culture bearers to other parts of the world. And if you, again, pay close attention to the stories that are associated with ancient Egypt, for example, they tell themselves that their civilization was delivered from outside, that they did not invent civilization. There was a wonderful Egyptian historian by the name of Manetho, who wrote about 300 years before Christ, and he codified, he wrote down all of the Egyptian cosmologies, the stories, the beginnings of their own time. And they talk about a time in which, long before Egyptian civilization got going, there was an island. They describe it as an island beyond the 12th bow, as they refer to it. That is the Atlantic Ocean. The 12th bow was a kind of early form of latitude that the Egyptians used on their very early maps. And the story goes that on this great island that was out in what we refer to today as the Near Atlantic, there was this magnificent island kingdom in which early men and gods lived together, and the gods shared their wisdom with early men. But that over time, human beings became arrogant, assumed that they had their own powers now, and they didn't need the gods anymore. And as a consequence, we're told that the gods evacuated this island, left the island to itself, to its ungrateful human beings. And when the gods left, they chose a few leaders, a few human beings with them. They left in a great solar boat, we're told. And as the gods and early men departed from this island, the island sank into the sea and was covered by the waters. And that the solar boat landed at the Nile Delta, and there the first human beings were met by the gods and these survivors of this sunken island, and the result was a hybrid civilization known as Egyptian civilization. What's interesting is the name of this island. They call it Sekhret Aru. You find this name in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And Sekhret Aru means field of reeds. Field of reeds denotes a place of very great learning because the reed was used as a pen, as a reed pen. They literally dipped it in an ink pot and they could write with it. So if you had a whole field of reeds, it was a field of great pens, a field of great literacy, a connotation for wisdom, a place of high learning. On the other side of the world, in the Valley of Mexico, the Maya and the Aztecs and the Zapotecs and all of the high cultures that developed in Middle America told that their civilization was also an import and that their founding father's name was the Feathered Serpent. The Maya called him Kukulkan, the Aztecs called him Quetzalcoatl. He was known as Gucumans. It's all the same thing. He's the Feathered Serpent. And they say that he and his family and followers came from an island in the Atlantic Ocean, and that they arrived on the shores of Mexico, at Veracruz, literally, and that they donated their high culture to the native peoples, and a hybrid civilization arose called Mesoamerican civilization. Now, the island from which they came is called Aztlan, A-Z-T-L-A-N, in the Aztec language called Tenoche. And Aztlan has two meanings. One is the white island, white meaning not racially, white referring to the east, because white is a color associated with the east. But Aztlan also means Field of Reeds. And it also denotes a place of great learning because the Aztecs and their predecessors also used reeds as an ink pen. So here you have two totally different people separated in time and space. The ancient Egyptians, who said that their founding fathers came from a sunken island called the Field of Reeds. And then on the other side of the world, in the Valley of Mexico, you have native peoples, the Aztecs and the Maya, who say their civilization was an import brought over by high culture bearers who came from the Field of Reeds. Well, what all this sounds like, of course, is we go back now to Plato. Plato, who lived about 2,300, 400 years ago, is one of the great masterminds of Western civilization. I mean, the credentials for the story of Atlantis that he told couldn't get any higher. All of America, all of our American and European ethics stem from his writings. I mean, he's one of the most important single figures in all of Western history. And yet his critics will today, who don't believe in Atlantis, say that he was, you know, just a myth maker or a storyteller. But nonetheless, his story of Atlantis rings incredibly close to these other historical and prehistorical explanations that people've had around the world for the origins of civilization from a high culture that arose in prehistoric times on an Atlantic island.
Absolutely fascinating. And you've just mentioned that one of my great all-time historical heroes, Manetho, he's just fantastic. And he's, of course, as a side note, he's one of those people who wrote the history of ancient Egypt and mentions the fact that the gods lived in ancient Egypt and that Egypt went far further down than 3000 BC. But again, the archaeologists and historians just cut him off halfway. And do not look at the other evidence. Now, your most recent book is, not your most recent book, but your most recent book on the subject of Atlantis is Atlantis in 2012. So where does the 2012 connection feature into?
Well, and just what we've been talking about, Philip, with all of the discussion about 2012 that's naturally coming up, 2012 is supposedly the end of the Mayan calendar, which takes place on the winter solstice, the morning of the winter solstice, the equivalent of our year 2012. And I read a number of books that have come out about it. There are more all the time. And they're all interesting. They all have valid things to say. I'm not saying my book is any better than any of the rest of them. But what I wanted to do was find out two things before I wrote this book, incorporated these two questions into my book. First, what did the Maya really say about 2012? And second, what are the chances of what they said actually going to take place on the winter solstice of 2012. So based on those two questions, I began researching my book. And I found, as I said, that the Maya claimed that all of their high culture came from elsewhere, and that all the Maya could claim to do were to be good custodians, good stewards of what was bequeathed to them by the feathered serpent. The name feathered serpent is interesting. It's not his real name. It's a title that he was associated with. And the feathers may be a reference to either an insignia he wore, which is interesting because the ancient Egyptians had an insignia known as the uraeus, which was nothing less than a snake with wings on it, a feathered serpent. And it was worn by Pharaoh over his forehead or his third eye, if people want to go further with that. Or the feathered serpent may be a kind of poetic analogy for someone who is bearded, and because the Mesoamerican people, the native people, are beardless. And so to see someone with a full beard might have been a poetic analogy for feathers. In any case, the feathered serpent, according to what the Maya write now and what they told the Spaniards before the Spaniards exterminated them, or most of them, was that this high culture was responsible for everything that the Maya achieved. And the Maya could only at most elaborate on the greatness that they inherited from the feathered serpent. And part of that inheritance was the calendar. The Maya never claimed to have invented it. They claimed only to have preserved it and to tweaked it, as it were, to help to develop it over time. I found out that there really is no Mayan calendar in this sense. First of all, the Maya did not invent it. They just carried it forward. And second, it is not a calendar. It's not like something you hang on your wall and look at some date. It's an almanac. It's like a farmer's almanac. What it does is it follows the cycles and patterns of nature, and it tries to make forecasts on what will happen in the future, developing from this concept of patterns and cycles. And as we know, the Farmer's Almanac has got some things right and some things wrong, but nonetheless, it's an almanac. It's a prognostication device. And that's exactly what the so-called Mayan calendar is. So in the first place, the Mayans did not invent it. They inherited it. In the second place, it's an almanac. And the purpose of this almanac is to forecast major cycles of time. And the reason why it's doing this is because these cycles of time are associated with world-changing events. The best way to understand the Mayan calendar is to envision a very simple and, or not simple, but a rather very well-known device known as the Aztec calendar stone. And the Aztec calendar stone, of course, is this great disc or circle, very ornate imagery on it, and at the center is the face of a man with his tongue sticking out. Now, this Aztec calendar stone is a materialization of the Mesoamerican calendar, and that's really what it needs to be referred to as, not as the Mayan calendar, but as the Mesoamerican almanac. That's what we're really looking at. We know, for example, that before the Maya had a calendar, a previous people called the Olmec, who are the oldest known civilizers in the Americas, they also possessed the calendar, a version of it. We only have fragments of it. We don't know as much as we know about the Aztec calendar. The Aztec calendar stone is a materialization, a physical representation of the calendar. And it's great that we have it because it shows visually just what the calendar is about. In the center is this ghastly figure, mask, of a man with his mouth open and his tongue hanging out, and on his tongue are human hearts. And he is grasping in his claws human hearts. And at the base of this disc, there are two human beings, human profiles, facing each other, and there are human hearts dangling out of their clenched teeth. And then around this horrible figure are four boxes or squares. And in these squares are representations, visual symbols, representations of what the Maya and the Aztecs believed were four previous global catastrophes. And the most recent one is called Four Athol, or Nahui Athol, or Four Water. The name, the appellation of Four is to indicate the four cardinal directions, which means it was global. And this was the great flood after which the Feathered Serpent and his followers arrived as flood survivors, deluge survivors, who brought their technology to Mesoamerica. And before that, there was the fire from heaven, in which there was a great firestorm in the sky and pushed human beings to the brink of extinction. And then going back further in time, there was something known as Four Wind, a great wind that encircled the earth that virtually killed off human beings. And then the very earliest one is called Four Ocelotl, or Four Jaguar, in which human beings were almost exterminated by confrontations with wild beasts. Now, what they're talking about is that human beings over time are given the opportunity to become virtuous creatures and to live close in harmony with nature. This is the principle of Mesoamerican metaphysics. And that if human beings live close to nature, they live close to the will of God. But if they don't, they get out of sync, and that God visits great natural catastrophes upon the world. The Maya calendar forecasts another one of these catastrophes, which is supposed to take place on sunrise of the winter solstice, R 2012. And they say that this catastrophe will take place if human beings, as a species, as a whole, are still out of sync with the natural law. But that if human beings are in sync with natural law, then there will be no natural catastrophe. This is what the Maya say. This is not my interpretation. This is in their own cosmology, which is stated in their written records, which are now translatable, thanks to Linda Shealy and others, and also in the traditions they gave the Spaniards 500 years ago. So the Maya say that there will be a global catastrophe of some kind. They don't specify what kind. They do say there will be trouble with the sun. The reason why they say that is because a figure by the name of Bolon Yokte will descend on Earth at that time with his nine followers. The nine followers represent the nine levels of hell, and they will visit a terrible cataclysm in the world if human beings are not in sync with nature. That's what the Maya say. So that's the thing that I've investigated in the book.
It's all so interesting, and I want to just remind all of our listeners that you've got some really fantastic books out there about Atlantis, about the destruction of Atlantis, about Atlantis in 2012, and they are all really, truly fascinating, informative reading. And I just personally want to say one of the things that I love about your work, because I want to segue here while we still have time, because I want to talk about your new book, which I'm very, very excited about, Gods of the Runes, The Divine Shapers of Fate. This book is so beautiful and so interesting, but it feels to me like a little bit of a departure from what you have been doing, because it's very much a book of, there's a lot of spirit in this book. It's a very spiritual book, whereas I see a lot of your other work is very fact-driven and extraordinary in the amount of research that you do, and you've done the same amount of fact-driven research here in this book about the runes, but it also tells a bit of your spiritual journey. I loved the introduction of this book, where you talk about the different types of divination that you explored and what didn't work for you, and how you tried things like medicine cards and how they felt inauthentic to you, and how you then went to the tarot, and the tarot was never comfortable for you, and how ultimately you found yourself in this place of being completely fascinated by the runes. So I just wanted to shift gears and ask you to talk a little bit about how you fell in love with this subject of what the runes were and came to write this new book.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. That's very sweet of you to say all those kind words. I hope to live up to it. But it was kind of a different quest. Of course, there are so many people today that feel a little restless with conventional spirituality, shall we put it, institutionalized religion, which is fine, but that leaves something to be desired, I guess, in the modern world. And so people are looking for alternative ways of accessing their soul, really, of touching God, or putting oneself in the direction of spiritual energies. And part of the path that many people have chosen have been, as you say, the tarot cards and animal medicine cards, and they're all fine. They all work fine, but it's a very personal search, isn't it, to look for one's own soul. In my other books, I have never written in the first person because I'm not the person that's to be discussed here. I'm dealing with facts, as you say, and previous societies. But here, I took a personal point of view because I didn't know how else to explain a personal quest, which I hope the reader can identify with. And I wound up with the runes because they kind of spoke to me. They seemed very user-friendly, as it were, and there was really nothing negative about them. The tarot can get kind of dark sometimes. It's very truthful. It works. But the runes, I find, are more immediate. They're easier to use, as I say. Well, the runes are a kind of an alphabet that are associated with Vikings and the Norse people, and that's correct. It goes back about 1,000 years or more that the Vikings and the Norse did use this runic alphabet of 24 characters. However, in my research, I found that it goes back long before the Norse or the Vikings, and that I can't go into the details of this because it is very complex, but I came to a rather astounding conclusion, is that these characters, these glyphs, go back to the old Stone Age, that they might go back as far as 35 or 40,000 years ago, probably more like 35,000 years ago. This is the very beginnings of organized society in Western Europe, and that the reason why we know this now is because some of the runes that are used today, you can get rune alphabets, packs, and sets, many stores today. Many of these runes are duplicated in pebbles that were inscribed during Magdalenian times and earlier. That goes back about 15,000 years. The Magdalenians were pretty advanced Stone Age people, but there's evidence that some of the runes go back even earlier. And they do not appear to have been used in the beginning as a kind of an alphabet, any phonetic characters. They were used then as they're used today in kind of magical properties. They were used as spiritual signposts, as it were. So it's very possible, and I believe most likely, that the runes are the oldest continuous use of divination, if you want, or spiritual tools that exist in the world today, that they predate anything in Asia or in Africa, and that this doesn't mean they're necessarily the best, but it does indicate that they are the oldest form of spiritual tools that we have at our disposal today.
Well, one of the things that I was really fascinated by and struck by, and I come from this generation of people who discovered runes through people like Murray Hope and Ralph Bloom, and who, you know, you make some mention of the fact that some of the more modern runic systems are not necessarily as well-researched or authentic as they should be. But one of the things that I fell in love with this book, and that I know that my readers are going to love, is how many female archetypes are associated, how many goddess characters, how many extraordinary sort of female paths of knowledge and wisdom are represented by these runes. And it was a complete shock to me. I had no idea. And as I paged through this beautiful book, and the very first time I picked it up, and I want to just mention that the illustrations by Ian Daniels are stunning. They're just beautiful. That was the first thing that really grabbed me. I said, oh my gosh, I've got to read this right now. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about this feminine aspect, these extraordinary female characteristics that are associated with some of these runes.
Well, that's a really great point you bring up, Kathleen. And that's one of the beefs that I have with modern runologists, is that they have, for the most part, completely ignored the feminine aspect of the runes. And that's it guts it, really. It makes them almost impotent, because the runic system was built on the idea of male and female energies realized and in balance. That means that half of the runes, 50% of them, are based on these female energies, and the other half are the male energies. What that means is it's not just as a matter of sexual division. Male energy represents consciousness, full consciousness, materialization, building things, bringing things into reality. Female consciousness represents intuition. It represents nurturing, the psychic side, and that the Norse and the people long before the Norse, their old Stone Age ancestors, realized that the cosmos is built on the cooperation and the harmony of these two divisions of energy, male and female energies. Every human being, whether a man or woman, has male and female energies in balance within themselves, or supposedly in balance within themselves, but they have those energies in themselves. There's that part of us that wants to bring into materialization those dreams of ours that we have, and yet those dreams are in themselves feminine in nature. So the runes originally recognize these two sets of energies, and when you recognize that, and through Ian Daniels' wonderful work, the book, I must admit, is a very lovely work, thanks in large measure to Ian Daniels' wonderful conception. Not only is he technically a very highly accomplished artist, I think he's really tuned in to the spiritual nature of the runes as they are personified in these gods and goddess figures. We're not dealing just with myths here. The whole concept of religion or spirituality is irrational. To try to apply the rational mind to spiritual energies is a mistake. It's like trying to apply rational thought to falling in love or listening to music and loving music. It's another side of our being, of our reality. and the myths and the paintings that are associated with this and the stories are to be understood in another way of understanding, an extra rational way. They're to appeal to our aesthetic sense, as it were, and that's why his paintings are so important. And that's what I've really tried to do, is to go back to the original concept of the runes, not using the rationalizations that have been applied to them. And I don't like the idea, especially, of someone having added a 25th rune. That was a very big mistake. 24 is a very sacred number. It's the division of 12, of course. 12 and 24 are numbers that are associated with the zodiac, the hours of the day, and this was understood by the creators of the runes, and to throw a 25th rune in is really to sabotage the entire concept of runology. And that's why the book, I guess, is kind of radical in that regard. Well, the truth is always radical in an age of falsehood, and I've tried to state the truth as best I can. And in this regard, the runes are 24, and they're divided between 12 male and 12 female energies. And those are the energies that only work.
Well, first of all of that was brilliantly stated. And this idea of, you know, for me, a lot of what's happening in the 21st century is this reawakening of this understanding that is exactly what you're talking about, these balance of male and female energies, bringing everything back into balance, recognizing...
And recognition of both, too, not just one over the other, but the recognition, the equal recognition of these energy sets. And not to say that, you know, that the male dominant... I'm completely against matriarchy or patriarchy. You know, you cannot have domination of one over the other. You must have cooperation. That's what it's all about. That's the only way I think that these energies can be realized, is when they are happily in harmony and cooperating. But one dominates the other, it leads to an imbalance. And, of course, in our history has shown us that one side does dominate, you know, mostly the patriarchal side, with horrendous consequences. And the runes teach us something totally different, and that is cooperation and harmony. And that goes back to the very basic concept of the perennial philosophy. And the perennial philosophy states that God, the Creator, wants human beings to cooperate and to create with Him. God wants human beings to be His co-creator, and that is what is stated most emphatically in the runes.
Well, you have done a brilliant job. The book is fantastic. It has really sort of reignited my interest in the runes again in a way that I never thought would happen.
Oh, great. That's wonderful.
Yeah, so I'm very excited to explore that and to share this with other people for all of the reasons that you're saying, that there is this extraordinary, balanced, beautiful, integrated, cooperative, co-creative information in this book and within this process. So I just wanted to say thank you for the extraordinary work that you do, for bringing this kind of magic and science and history all together to my listeners and readers. Frank's book, Gods of the Runes, is the best $18 you're going to spend this month, so I recommend it with all my heart.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet of you, Kathleen, and I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss these questions with you.
And it's a pleasure to have you on our show, Frank. You definitely are a true spirit revolutionary. We will send you the badge later. And just to recap, you have written so many things. So your latest one is Gods of the Runes, but you also have written Advanced Civilizations of Prehistoric America. You have written on Atlantis, and your most recent one is Atlantis in 2012. If you want to hear this interview again, you can go to the BBS archive. You can go to iTunes and search for The Spirit Revolution. You can also go to our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. We say a fond farewell and hopefully until the next time, Frank, because you are a writing machine as we are speaking, and we hope you keep churning them out so we can have you back on our show. Until the next time, from Kathleen and me,
the truth against the world.